From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump's embattled Postmaster General fielded tough questions from senators today after some Democrats accused him of trying to sabotage the Postal Service as it prepares to handle a surge of mail-in ballots for this year's election. In a virtual Senate hearing, Louis DeJoy blasted what he called false narratives about his plans to shake up the Postal Service and repeatedly assured members of the Homeland Security Committee that the post office is ready to handle election mail.
Since my arrival, we've established and extended a task force. We have put up a website or putting up a website within a day. And we are diligently working to ensure the American public and to ensure a successful election.
NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell has been following the hearing and joins us now. Kelsey, let's start with how we got here. The Postal Service has long suffered financial problems. But earlier this month, DeJoy, who is a Republican fundraiser and Trump donor, announced cuts to the agency, and Democrats have been very concerned that this is an effort to make it more difficult for people to vote by mail.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, he says in his testimony today that those changes that he announced were already underway before he became Postmaster General. He basically told Congress repeatedly that he didn't know that these changes were happening. He said he didn't even know that post boxes were being removed or that mail sorting machines were being removed until he heard about it the same way that everybody else did through media reports. So he is more or less saying that he was not responsible for the changes, though Democrats have pressed him further on that and are quite skeptical of his interpretation.
Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire pressed him on the issue of transparency. Let's listen.
Mr. DeJoy, I'm just wondering, do you have a detailed plan about how you're going to ensure the kind of delivery that Americans count on for voting by mail? Do you have a more detailed plan than what's in your letter, yes or no?
There are detailed processes that we are going through. We just announced the expanded election committee within the operation, and our board has established one. But there are detailed plans that we go through in every election. And with regard
to... could you share those with Congress? And could you share them by Sunday night so we can see what they are, please?
I don't think I will have the complete plan by Sunday night.
The ranking Democrat on the committee, Gary Peters, asked about overtime pay because DeJoy has announced cuts to overtime for postal workers, which could have the effect of slowing down the mail. Did Democrats get any new information or assurances about the Postal Service from DeJoy today?
No, they got assurances from DeJoy that he believes that the election will go off without a hitch. He essentially said that there are no changes to the way election mail is processed in 2020 from the way it was processed in the past. But they did feel that they were not getting specifics. We heard Hassan there asking for more information. But like you mentioned, Gary Peters pressed because he said he's been trying to reach out to DeJoy and get answers for weeks and said that he was not hearing anything back, particularly on the overtime question. He wanted DeJoy to explain whether or not reductions were happening. Because, you know, a lot of the information that we've been seeing about the Postal Service over the past couple of weeks has been anecdotal. We've seen photos of places where blue boxes used to be, or we've seen photos and video of sorting machines in parking lots. And so there is this attempt by Democrats and Republicans as well to kind of figure out where the anecdotal evidence and the concerns meet with the, you know, the policies that are in place. And so far, DeJoy really hasn't provided a lot of the information they want to have to feel confident about what the answer to that is.
Mm-hmm. Now, DeJoy did say today that he votes by mail and has voted by mail for years. But with all of the questions about whether the Postal Service is going to be able to handle the influx of mail, what did DeJoy say about that?
You know, he said that there is slack in the system, that they are able to do that. But one of the things that Democrats have pointed out to me over the past couple of days is that, you know, the things that they're taking out, the systems that they're taking out of post offices right now, the sorting machines are to sort letters, and ballots are letters, essentially. So they do have remaining concerns about whether or not this will be processed the way that DeJoy is saying it will.
And DeJoy is going to appear before a House Oversight Committee on Monday as well?
Yeah, we're watching there particularly for more information about his appointment and his potential conflicts of interest, something that Democrats have been questioning pretty significantly.
That is NPR's Kelsey Snell, who has been watching a hearing today on Capitol Hill with Louis DeJoy, the Postmaster General. Kelsey, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the first virtual Democratic National Convention has come to a close with Joe Biden giving a sweeping message to Americans.
Let us begin, you and I together, one nation, under God, united in our love for America, united in our love for each other. For love is more powerful than hate. Hope is more powerful than fear. And light is more powerful than dark. This is our moment. This is our mission. May history be able to say that the end of this chapter of American darkness began here tonight as love and hope and light join in the battle for the soul of the nation. And this is a battle we will win, and we'll do it together. I promise you.
Let's take a look now at the present and the future of the Democratic Party. And for that, we have Joshua Harris Till. He's the president of the Young Democrats of America. Joshua, welcome. And this all virtual convention, was it successful?
I believe so. Unfortunately, there's a little exclusivity for the DNC convention because so much of it happens on the ground. And the world doesn't get to see it. But for this one to be virtual for everybody who wanted to watch any part of it, I think, you know, that really brought them in, showed them the real DNC, showed them the real party. And so for that, I think it was amazing.
I want to ask you, though, about some of the criticism. So there's been some criticism of the DNC for not featuring younger voices in the party and for not spending enough time with the progressive voices that excite many young voters. For example, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was just given 90 seconds to speak. Did you hear a dearth of young voices from your view?
It's a very valid criticism. You can't say that young people, you know, are the future of the party when we are actually leaders in the party right now. And on top of that, we are the largest voting bloc. I can understand that, you know, AOC doesn't get a whole lot of time because she's a freshman Congress member, but there are so many other young voices besides Pete Buttigieg that they could have tapped and invited in to speak.
You speak to a couple of different things there, but ultimately, you know, it's always been a challenge to get younger voters to come out to the polls and vote. And this time we're in an unprecedented situation. I mean, a survey from earlier this summer shows that more than half of voters under the age of 35 say they don't have the resources or knowledge to vote by mail. We heard the Obamas and other speakers make a call for disillusioned people to vote. But on a practical level, how does the party get ballots in the hands of these young voters?
They actually invest in youth organizations. So, you know, the Young Democrats of America is the largest partisan youth organization in the country. And the fact that we weren't approached directly from the beginning and say, hey, this is your initiative, these are the resources for you to do it, is just us missing opportunities. We talk about reaching young people, but we have an army of young people who are already involved in the party, who have been waiting on direction and for too long haven't been getting the investment and direction that they needed in order to truly support whoever's at the top of the ticket. We have the ability, we have the manpower, we have the boots on the ground, so to say. But so often campaigns don't just reach out to us.
Is it too late? I mean, we're talking about just a couple of months until the election happens. Are you confident there's enough time to turn this around or deepen those relationships with young voters in these organizations that you're talking about?
Oh, for sure. I think that the amount of convincing that you have to do for our elders who are voters is not the amount of convincing that you have to do for young people. You show us that you care, you make an investment, and we'll support you. That's why Bernie Sanders did so well. That's why Beto did so well. It's because they knew that young people were their base and they spoke to them directly. They didn't have to spend 30 years fostering relationships. They did in a couple of months. And so I think we have that opportunity now. We just have to be very intentional on it.
So the convention has come to an end. You're moving forward in your work. You're pushing for a call to action from the Biden campaign to really engage with younger voters. Are you feeling hopeful for the fall?
You know, I am. I think that what we saw the last couple of days was just inspirational. Seeing Braden read a speech, having the young lady whose father passed away from COVID speak some very powerful words. That's what, you know, we're doing this for. That's why we love this party. That's why we haven't given up on it. That's why we can remain hopeful, because there's so many different reasons and so many different people who may have had it a little bit harder in life than we have, and they still believe. And so we have to believe for them, and we have to create a better environment and a better country for them.
That's Joshua Harris Till, president of the Young Democrats of America. Joshua, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The Ellen DeGeneres Show fired three senior producers this week after weeks of mounting pressure on the show. Former employees claim that DeGeneres oversaw a hostile work environment. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us for more on this. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Well, and at the start of this year, Ellen DeGeneres was honored with a Carol Burnett Award at the Golden Globes. This is what she said then.
The real power of television for me is that not that people watch my show, but people watch my show and then they're inspired to go out and do the same thing in their own lives. They make people laugh or be kind or help someone that's less fortunate than themselves. And that is the power of television, and I'm so, so grateful to be a part of it.
So that was then, and now three senior producers fired. For people who haven't been paying attention to this, what exactly led to this moment?
Well, I guess the biggest contributing factor was that there were two investigative stories that were published in BuzzFeed that detailed allegations from people who used to work on the show who talked about a toxic work environment where some executive producers were accused of sexually propositioning people who worked there. A woman of color, a black woman who worked there, claimed that she was marginalized. Other people claim that when they tried to take time off for medical issues or for personal issues, they paid a price for it. And, you know, Ellen always talks about being nice. She's had segments on her show talking about National Kindness Day. She has a whole subscription service set up called Be Nice, where you can sign up and you can receive products that are supposedly things you can either use to be nice to yourself or that are nice to the environment. And yet, there's all these rumors that behind that, she's not very nice at all. And this story seemed to confirm those rumors.
So three senior producers fired. Who are they? And is Ellen at risk here? Ellen herself?
I would say that Ellen is not at risk because Ellen is the show. Ellen is the franchise. And not only does she have this talk show, which sort of came along and I think kind of it took Oprah Winfrey's place. You know, Oprah Winfrey was sort of the spiritual guru of daytime talk for a very long time. When she left her show, Ellen DeGeneres comes along, and now she has sort of assumed that mantle. Mm-hmm. To get rid of her, of course, would be to end the show. So instead, they have let go three producers, named Ed Glavin, Kevin Lehman, and Jonathan Norman. I think all of them were accused of various acts of harassment. Mm. But two other producers who've been with the show since it was started, who were also sort of singled out for enabling this toxic environment, they will still be working on the show. Ellen is maintaining she didn't know anything. I got to say, it is possible for things to go down that you don't know, but to have day to day, week to week, month to month, year to year, a toxic workplace and be completely unaware of it is something that strains credulity. But that is what she's maintaining. And these producers who have left the show have been accused of harassment have, a few of them have also denied the allegations. So we'll see if the show can keep going.
Even though many people are reevaluating their opinion of DeGeneres right now, she has been a trailblazing figure. She broke ground as an openly gay woman in the entertainment industry. She came out in her show on TV in 1997, which was before Will and Grace even existed. Does that still count, do you think, for people who are evaluating the situation?
Well, I think there are a lot of people who are Ellen DeGeneres fans who will just chalk this up to sort of runaway celebrity journalism, and they'll be in her corner until something much more directly damning of her comes out. I think her legacy is a little tarnished because she's also built her brand around being a showbiz survivor, you know, someone who faced a lot of homophobia. You know, she came out personally at the same time as the character on her sitcom Ellen came out. And then there was a backlash against the show. It was canceled about a year afterwards. And she was afraid her career was over. So the fact that she was able to, a few years later, establish this, you know, really hopeful talk show and reinvent herself and become a show business success again, to have at the end of that this coda where stories come out that she's, at the very least, she's allowed the victimization of other marginalized people working on her staff. You know, that's a terrible thing. It is also a story as old as Hollywood. And so, you know, I think it's very likely that she'll get past this. Yahoo News is reporting that they're giving some perks to the staff who are there, giving them a vacation time and discretionary time to try and boost everybody's spirits and ease up on this idea that they expect people to work really hard, long hours. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't know if there's a lot of incentive for them to look really closely at changing the center of what they do if two of the people who were accused get to keep their jobs and Ellen isn't really penalized.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thank you.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Well, the coronavirus pandemic has brought almost all live concerts to a halt, but in the UK, they've figured out how to pull off safe, socially distant arena shows. That sound from English singer-songwriter Sam Fender's concert last week at the Virgin Money Unity Arena in Newcastle, his hometown. That is a 30,000-person arena, but in this case, it was at less than 10% capacity, and everyone was socially distanced. Sam Fender joins us from Newcastle, England. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Mano. You doing? You all right?
Doing okay. And tell me about this. How did it work to have a socially distant show in an arena?
Basically, they set up these stands, sort of, they kind of looked like pens. To be honest, it was like playing to the biggest human cattle market on earth. It looked a bit crazy. So you'd have five people, you know, within your bubble on a platform or in one of the pens down the front. There was plenty of space between each one. And there was, you know, security were just kind of keeping an eye on the odd few people who tried to go crazy at the end. But apart from that, it was pretty amicable and like, it seemed very safe and coordinated. But like, I genuinely thought it was great. It was much better than I expected. Like, I was obviously skeptical when I went out and I thought, you know, is this going to work? It's 2,500 people in a 30,000 cap space. Like, I was like, it's probably not going to have the same feel. But I think the crowd made up for it because there was so much pent-up frustration from lockdown that people seemed to be singing a hell of a lot louder than they probably would have been if it was last year. So 2,500 people, you know, they might as well have been 10,000. They sounded so loud. So there was a live band. We were playing. They were singing. They were all drunk. The British weather came out and rained on us all. It felt like a gig. Felt like I was at a festival. So I was really happy. I think it's good that we've got something to at least look forward to while we're waiting for this pandemic to go away and eventually disappear, hopefully.
Yeah, I have to say, I have been to one event, one sort of entertainment event since all of this started. It was outside, and it was the same thing you're talking about, where people were in the groups that they came with. They were seated in a specific place where they were distant from the next group of people. But it was so nice to actually see a performance. Did you talk to people that went and asked how it went for them, for the audience?
Yeah. Well, I obviously had a few friends turn up and stuff, and I've got quite a few friends who are have sort of, you know, bad social anxieties and stuff, and they said it was, they were loving it because they had their kind of own space. But for my other friends who are obviously we were missing the mosh pits, but it was I think everybody was just dying to have that communal feeling of being galvanized by live music, and everyone just singing in as one was enough to give us all a bit of euphoria in this really difficult, weird time that we live in.
Now, you were touring so much more before the shutdown, playing huge arenas full of people. What has this time been like for you as an artist?
It sucks. I'm not going to beat around the bush, like, but this lockdown happened the day before we were about to do our biggest like arena tour ever in the UK. And then we were, as soon as that tour was done, we were going to fly over to New York and come over to your side of the pond and record in New York. And this moment for me in my head was like, I'd arrived, you know what I mean? It was the pinnacle of my career so far. So for that to just sort of suddenly stop, and I guess at the beginning of the lockdown, everyone was kind of hopeful that people weren't really fully sort of clued up on it. And I thought, maybe it'll be okay in a couple of months or whatever. And then it obviously all sunk in. So it's been pretty somber, to say the least. And I think most, at least we've still got a job. There's lots of people that have lost jobs, and a lot of my friends got made redundant the moment this happened. So, you know, I count my blessings for that. But creatively, it was quite hard to kind of remain focused when I was just sitting in my hometown. But we've just got to look forward.
So Sam Fender, we have this segment on our show that we do every week called the DJ Sessions, where we bring on a DJ and have them tell us about five or so songs that they've been listening to. And we had one last year with a DJ from the BBC's Radio 6 named Chris Hawkins, who actually brought a song from you called The Borders and played it for our audience. So I will ask you, as we close out this chat, which song that you've been performing, that you would have performed at this arena show for these 2,500 socially distant people, would you like us to play?
The Borders, definitely.
All right. The reprise of The Borders on Here and Now. Sam Fender, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, man.
Can see what Sam Fender's show looked like. It's pretty amazing, and maybe the near-term future of concerts. That's at hereandnow.org.
The pandemic is forcing many cities to rethink outdoor spaces. In New York, where indoor dining is still not allowed, the city has made it easier for restaurants to set up tables on streets and sidewalks. As Camille Peterson reports, restaurants are hoping this will help them get back in business.
These days, many New York streets are a sea of outdoor dining. Tables, plants, trees, umbrellas, and they're now fenced in by barricades with flower boxes and hanging plants. Whitney Kuo is sitting outside a restaurant in Brooklyn. She chose to eat here after looking at other restaurants and finding the tables were not far apart enough to be safe.
I like to peek at everything and always see what's going on, and most places freak me out.
Kuo's friend, Sofia Scarlatos, said she had a bad experience eating outdoors at a different place.
And it was pretty dirty, because it was like kind of in a gutter, my table.
That's why the two of them ended up at this Brooklyn restaurant, Hunky Dory. Hunky Dory's outdoor seating area is in a big lot next to the restaurant. It's surrounded by a fence and blocked off from street traffic, and Kuo says Hunky Dory is
the only place where I've seen the tables like actually almost 10 feet apart.
Before July, Hunky Dory had no outdoor seating, and this area was an empty lot.
Barbed wire fence across the top, pretty bleak.
That's Claire Sprouse. She owns Hunky Dory. She struck up a deal with the lot's owner to fix it up and use it for outdoor dining. It's costing her about $10,000 at a time when her business is scraping by after being closed to dining for months during the pandemic.
Which is why it's so scary, like, thinking about, like, how long we'll be able to use this.
That's because Mayor Bill de Blasio has only relaxed restrictions on outdoor dining through October 31st. As long as restaurants keep a path clear for pedestrians and follow other guidelines, they can apply to put seating on sidewalks and parking spaces. A few blocks away from Hunky Dory, Felucio Adeyamo has not opened outdoor dining at his restaurant, Suya, which has limited sidewalk space. but he wants restaurants in the neighborhood that do have lots of outdoor space to thrive. He says it brings more customers to the area.
They're going to walk around, they're going to go, and they're going to trickle down, like, let's see what's up, you know? So it's just one of those things where it's just like, bigger outside seating, excellent. Please, please do it, you know?
Over in Chinatown, the narrow sidewalks and tightly packed storefronts make outdoor dining a particular challenge. Wellington Chen leads the Chinatown Business Improvement District, which has converted an entire street into an outdoor dining hall.
We're doing all we can to make sure they have a fighting chance.
On a hot and muggy afternoon, customers were eating wonton soup and Peking duck. Chen says since the dining hall opened last week, restaurants have seen an increase in business. But making outdoor dining work in a big city like New York is not easy.
It's crowded, noisy, and in the summertime, sometimes a little bit stinky. You get a lot of humidity.
Stephanie Robson teaches restaurant design at Cornell. She says restaurants have to overcome all of those challenges.
And there's something else they're trying to do, which is convey a little bit about the restaurant experience that they have inside on the outside.
Robson says the message is, look, it's us. On this concrete lot or this sidewalk, among the shrubs and barricades, we're still the same restaurant. For NPR News, I'm Camille Peterson in New York.
Lyft and Uber won't be suspending service in California after all. The two ride-hailing companies won an appeal yesterday against a ruling that would have forced them to classify their workers as employees in California, requiring them to provide health insurance and other full benefits. As it stands, drivers for the companies are classified as independent contractors, which means workers pay for their own expenses. But this legal fight is not over. In November, residents in the state will vote on Proposition 22, a measure heavily funded by Uber and Lyft that would exempt them from the state law requiring this classification. Two Lyft drivers join us now to talk about what this could mean for their futures. Sherry Murphy, a driver in Oakland, California, is against Proposition 22. And Jonathan Panzer of Austin, Texas, who likes working as an independent driver, is watching closely to what happens in California. And he joins us via Skype. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Same.
Sherry, I want to start with you because you drive for Lyft here in California. You've been doing this for about 3 years now. Both companies claim that classifying drivers as employees would overturn their business model and increase rates for passengers. How do you see it?
What happened on yesterday was a tactic where you see bosses do to employers when they practice their voice, when there are no protections and no benefits in place. And Lyft and Uber are trying to buy, cheat, and steal their way out of responsibility. We're ordinary people in the middle of a pandemic, and because Lyft and Uber refuses to follow the law, we're having, among folks, one of the highest employment rate here in California. People are losing housing, and they are heavily impacted by a disease that has the potential to kill us. So our sights have always been set on defeating Prop 22 because we believe that we should be treated with some dignity and respect.
Jonathan, what are your thoughts on this?
This is really challenging for me because my politics definitely align very much with labor, with workers' rights. My concern is that I, as an individual driver who works in the nonprofit sector in one of the most expensive cities in the country, in the most expensive city in the state, and according to USA Today, the most expensive city for low-income workers in the country, I need to be able to survive. And Lyft has allowed me the flexibility and the capacity not only to survive, but also to be able to save up enough money potentially for a house. And if I was classified as a full-time employee, I would most likely lose a massive amount of income, and therefore I'd have to get a second job in order for me to continue to maintain my income level. So it really is tricky for me. I would love to see like an opt-in option where drivers who want to benefit from benefits could do that, and the drivers who choose to stay kind of independent contractors could do that as well.
Sherry, you actually stopped driving for Lyft temporarily back in March because of many of the things that you just talked about, understandably worried about potential exposure to the coronavirus. Have you felt that you've had to choose between your health and your income at this point?
Absolutely. At the onset of COVID-19 pandemic, gig workers like myself were faced with what I would call a devil's choice. And there's nothing about this Proposition 22 that protects my health and well-being, not only for myself and for my family, but for the passengers as well. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, in Oakland, every full-time worker has about 80 hours of sick pay compensated. If Prop 22 passes, a bill that is trying to be purchased and bought by Lyft, it retroactively kills city ordinances like this one in Oakland, the one in San Francisco, San Jose, and Los Angeles. And I want to address my brother's point around flexibility. There's nothing in the statute in the state of California that prohibits Lyft and Uber from dismissing a flexible schedule. It's a scare tactic that avoids the fact that if this proposition passes, we stand to lose at least $500 a week under this law.
So, Sherry, what you're ultimately saying is that these companies can provide both. They can provide flexibility, but also more supports to drivers. It's not an and or type of situation.
Absolutely not. And this is not anything that's been new. They're more concerned about their bottom line than with their workers.
Jonathan, you know, a big reason why we wanted to talk with you about your experience is because what happens in California could potentially impact drivers throughout the country. You've been driving Lyft for the past 5 years. You primarily work for a nonprofit, but you've offset that salary by driving for Lyft. How concerned are you about what will happen in November in California and how it might impact states like Texas?
From my understanding, it won't impact us directly, at least initially, because Texas law supersedes California law, obviously.
Sure.
My biggest concern, though, because I was working in the nonprofit sector, but I lost my job because of the coronavirus, I'm very concerned about my ability to make as much as I want to be able to make, and I choose to do that. And if I was to be made a full-time employee, I would almost guarantee to lose a massive amount of income, and I'd be forced to get another job and make less in the long run, ultimately. So it's a complicated issue, obviously. I want to support as many of my labor friends as possible, but at the end of the day, I personally want to do everything I can to make sure that I'm taken care of, while at the same time doing what we can do to take care of everyone else.
Sherry, what do you say to this? Because we've heard this from lots of drivers who say, we like this flexibility. We like the ability to be able to work as many hours as we want or as little hours as we want. And being classified as a full-time employee will hinder our ability to make more money. You're basically saying that this is, though, a false narrative from the companies, that there is a way to offer flexibility. But do you see another path forward?
I don't see another path forward with Prop 22 when it weakens labor and benefit protections. Zero sick pay, sick days, zero family leave, zero workers' compensation or disability, no cap on medical expenses, no access to PPE, no sanitary facilities, and we are at risk of workplace violence. And I want to be clear, there is nothing in the statute that prevents Lyft and Uber from providing that flexibility. As a matter of fact, if this proposition passes, there was a study by the UC Berkeley Labor Center that found that this pay guarantee would amount to about $5.64 an hour for drivers. So I'm with my brother. I want to be able to work when I want to work and make the money when I want to make the money, but I also want to be safe about it. And this proposition is not safe.
You know, one thing I'm hearing from Sherry, Jonathan, is that everything has kind of been changed by COVID-19. All of the things that may have been slight concerns before the pandemic are now major concerns when it comes to drivers' safety. Does that change in any way your calculation and thinking about wanting to be independent versus this idea of Lyft and Uber offering what would traditionally be thought of as full-time employment with all of the protections?
I mean, obviously, it's something that I consider. I think about it every day because I haven't had a full day off since January. Like, I work weekends. I work 8 to 10 hours a day. I have parents who are immunocompromised. So I absolutely see that. Until we get something like Medicare for All, which I'm personally hugely supportive of, I need to look out for myself. And I take precautions in my car. I clean the car stringently. I'm always very wary of communicating with passengers, making sure that they wear masks, making sure that if I need PPE that I have enough. But there is a risk, and it's unfortunate that we have to live with that. And I wish we would have the leaders at Uber and Lyft would think more about the driver's day-to-day instead of the bottom line.
Sherry, I'm going to give you the last word. Ultimately, what do you want the regular public to take away from all of this? So much of the conversation has been on these companies and then drivers, but I'm also thinking about folks who use Lyft and Uber, and they're part of this whole equation as well.
What I want them to take away from this is that there have been drivers who have died as a result of Lyft and Uber's inability to show up for their workers. There have been drivers who have been symptomatic, yet still continue driving because of their fear of financial ruin. And so it's vital that we treat this proposition as if it's a public health concern. And that means that we have to vote no on Proposition 22.
Sherry Murphy is a Lyft driver in Oakland, California, and Jonathan Panzer is a Lyft driver in Austin, Texas. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
The first ever virtual Democratic National Convention has wrapped up. And since there was no audience in person, like there usually is, a lot of the reaction has come from social media. So let's get to Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, who talks with us each week about how the news is filtering through social media. Hi, Femi.
Hello. Are you exhausted, Jeremy?
I am a little exhausted. I'm on the East Coast, and it's like 11:15, 11:30 is a little late for me. But anyway,
well done. You did it.
I did it. Now, last night was Joe Biden's night, which was very late, but a lot of people are talking about a speech from 13-year-old Braden Harrington, who told us about meeting Joe Biden in New Hampshire. Let's listen to a little.
He told me that we were members of the same club. We stutter. It was really amazing to hear that someone like me became Vice President.
Now, this was a short speech, Femi, but it was so powerful. How did social media respond?
I was watching the speech, I was watching social, and it blew up at exactly the same time. And when people say, oh, that was so inspiring, it becomes a little bit cliche, but people started to share their stories on social. Vesuvius, for instance, says, you did a magnificent job, Braden Harrington. You rock. My dad had a stutter, which eventually subsided when he got older. He went into the Air Force, then college, a long career in the computer industry, and traveled the world. You'll do wonderful things in your life, too. That doctor lady says, Braden, you are such a brave young man. Your speech was awesome. Bissy will not be shushed, says, Braden, I'm so proud of you. Both of my sons stuttered and went through tough times. And then some blue tick admiration from Bette Midler. Wow, what a story. Dan Rather, the 13-year-old boy with a stutter, pure, unvarnished courage. Safe to say, people loved it. I also looked at Google Trends. So Google Trends for stuttering spiked when Braden Harrington started to speak. And also the same spike happened when people were just Googling to see who he was. So those two things go together.
What else trended from the DNC?
Also trending, Stefan and Aisha Curry and their little daughters, Ryan and Riley, talking about voting and politics. They're already really well known on social. So everybody found this totally adorable. Sarah Cooper, the comedian who lip-syncs the president's words. As Alan Fisher, who's a journalist, mentioned, the Sarah Cooper thing doesn't work on radio. You kind of have to see it to appreciate it. But people loved it. And there wasn't really a big build-up to her appearing as a speaker. So people really enjoyed it and enjoyed hearing what she really sounds like. And then a really, really touching emotional trend, and that was for Beau Biden. People really seem to appreciate and connect with the honor and the special piece that was done about Beau Biden, and they connected with Joe Biden through his loss. And I think that is really what the DNC were trying to do. Joe Biden, he connects with you. He connects with your pain. He's empathetic. And I think that really, when that whole piece about Beau Biden aired, that trended and people could connect with that.
Now, I watched most of the convention live, but it was a bit late, as we said. So some speeches I ended up watching on my phone the morning after. What were the most searched speeches from the convention?
Oh, this is really easy for me to find out, because just before 11:30 p.m. Eastern time on Thursday night, Google Trends had already got it. So in at number five, the most searched speeches for the whole of the week, Kamala Harris. Number four, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Number three, Joe Biden. Number two, Barack Obama. And in at number one, the top searched speeches from the 4 days of the DNC 2020 convention was...
A president's words have the power to move markets. They can start wars or broker peace. They can summon our better angels or awaken our worst instincts.
Michelle Obama, that first night.
Mm-hmm. And how did social media respond to the fact that this was a virtual convention? Some of it was live. Some of these speeches were taped. Michelle Obama's speech was taped. How did people respond?
A lot of appreciation for the format. Obviously, some snark as well, because there was lots to talk about. But for instance, Wall says, love this format. So intelligent and interesting. Rebecca L., I am much loving the convention and don't think I'm alone. Susan, they should never change back. This is so much better and informative. And also Jeffrey Nussbaum, who has been a political speechwriter, he added up how many speakers there were, how many live speakers, and he says that there was so much more packed into this Dem convention than a traditional convention, and this may well be the way forward.
Femi Oke, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, thanks as always. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too, Jeremy. Take care.
And if you missed any of the moments we were talking about, we will link to, for example, Braden Harrington's speech, as well as Michelle Obama's, at hereandnow.org. You can see what everybody's talking about. Tanya, you got the advantage of at least being on Pacific time for this convention.
Yeah, I wasn't up till midnight. Yes, like you, but I didn't get to watch.
But you have to get up earlier than we do.
It's true.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WVOR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The Republican National Convention begins, and like the Democrats, it will be a virtual gathering. President Trump is poised to be renominated to run for a second term against former Vice President Joe Biden. We'll have full coverage of the RNC and the latest on COVID-19. That's next time on Here and Now.